When you're ready, open your eyes gently and return to the room. I'm Don Paxman, and I'm considered an old student, and I haven't figured out if that's because I've been in this incarnation for so long or because I did my first retreat some 27 years ago. I've been through the Community Dharma Leaders Training Program, Spirit Rock, and some such. Before I get into my Dharma talk or any questions you may have, why don't we just take 15 or 30 seconds and a quick stretch for anybody who wants one. I want one. I've come down with a bit of a cold today, so I don't know how my voice is carrying, but if anybody has trouble hearing me, wave your hand or something and I'll try and speak up a bit. Before I get into the Dharma talk, does anybody have any questions about the instructions? I actually gave you quite a lot of instructions, particularly for people who are just sitting for the first or second time. And I'd also like any feedback as to whether that was helpful or actually a nuisance.
I thought it was helpful. It just helped me come back or just reminded me that I was still just doing what I had hoped to do.
I remember when I first started sitting, I would be gone sometimes for a half an hour. And so just having somebody say something, I'd have a moment of awareness before I tripped out again. Any questions about the instructions? Anything you'd like clarified? Cool. I think tonight I'll talk about sila, or morality. Unless somebody in the last week or two has done that talk, then I'll talk about something else. Is that something that's not going to be a quick repeat? This talk is really just for your reflection. Anything that I have to say is filtered through my experience, my lifetime, the impact of teachers on me, and the very heavy emphasis in Buddhist meditation is to go into this kind of material for yourself and to discover for yourself what is true. So I hope that this will be useful in that way. I particularly like to talk about morality for a couple of reasons. One, I continue to have trouble with it, so if you can't do it, teach it. And two, because I think in the Western transition of Theravadan Buddhism, there's a little less emphasis than appears to me to be true in the Eastern, with the Eastern teachers. At least as I read their books, there's much more emphasis on it. And actually, I don't know that I've heard a talk on sila or morality, except when I've been on retreat. And when you're on an intensive retreat, at least every experience I've had, you're asked to take the five basic precepts. Those are the five basic precepts that monks take, but they take an additional 227 or something besides these. If the five basic precepts sound a little bit like the Ten Commandments, you probably shouldn't be surprised. The first of the precepts is non-killing, not taking any life. And obviously it's not possible to totally do that, but to be very conscious about that obviously if you're walking outside, you're almost certainly going to step on some ants. But to the extent that it's possible to have your intention be such that you will not kill anything. The second of the five precepts is not stealing, not taking anything that isn't freely offered. That seems pretty clear. The third precept, which I find the most difficult, is right speech. That is, not telling lies, not exaggerating, not creating dissension in the community. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have opinions and express them, but the intent should be in a useful, helpful way rather than in a divisive, disharmonious way. The fourth precept is no sexual misconduct. And for a retreat, that's basically really simple. It means no sexual activity of any sort. But it's left very amorphous. What is sexual misconduct? And in fact, the Dalai Lama has gotten himself into a little trouble with some groups as to his attempts to define what sexual misconduct would be. There's been some strange things to come out of that. That is, it's all right for a man to visit a prostitute as long as he doesn't pay the prostitute. So at any rate, that may have changed. So it is the exploration of what is appropriate sexual behavior. And the fifth precept is no intoxicants or substances that cloud the mind. In Buddhism, the mind is critically important. We're practicing awareness. We're trying to develop moment-to-moment consciousness of what we're doing. And certainly any substance that interferes with that is liable to cause a problem. Now, those are the basic precepts. And what intrigues me about them, and I'm going to use a lot of material from Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Christ Mind, Buddha Mind, because I like what he does with it. Whatever you do, don't try and go as deep as I'm liable to go in my talk. Unless there are some already enlightened beings in here, you'll get into a lot of trouble with the subtleties that you can go to. So let's start with the first precept, non-killing. And it's very easy to take non-killing the next step to go to non-harming. And again, that's not very tricky. Whenever possible, don't cause pain and suffering to other beings. The Buddha said, in discussing sila, Refrain from what is detrimental. Attain what is wholesome. This is our practice. Precepts can point the way. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh goes a whole lot further than that. He goes from not only non-harming, but the next logical step, which is to alleviate the effects of harming, to alleviate suffering in whatever form and shape that it occurs. And you can keep getting finer and finer as to, you know, just how subtle you want to be with these things. I would say for me personally, this has been a relatively easy precept. Before I started practice, I had quick hands, and I could be sitting out in the sun getting cancer, reading a book, and a fly would come around, and I could just pick it right out of the air and be really proud of myself when I looked at the ground after an hour or two and there were bodies all over the place. Working with the first precept, that's just not possible anymore. I mean, I can't go to that place. And one of the very interesting things about working with this precept, and I'm going to just diverge for a second, the three characteristics of existence that the Buddha talked about were suffering, impermanence, and no self. And if you want to watch how you form a really good self, killing is a terrific way, because there's an ego trip in there that I'm important and the fly or the mosquito or whatever life form isn't important. And that is a great way to build this very strong sense of self. So I don't want to go into that a lot, but it might be something as your practice develops that you start noticing. So that for me, this whole precept of being really committed to doing what I can do to alleviate suffering in the world is very important. And that's why most of the sanghas over in the United States, they have so many service programs developing just locally, you know, the program to help neighbors and a prison project that's forming. And so there are a lot of things that, a lot of areas in which you can manifest the expression of non-harming and of alleviation of suffering. Sometimes that seems like too big a task for me. My God, there is so much suffering out there in the world. I mean, what can I possibly do about it? And I found that if I just smile at the checker in the supermarket instead of moaning and groaning about how much things cost, it changes. It changes. We don't have to do anything particularly heroic or, you know, enormous, just in paying attention to how we relate to each other and to total strangers on the street. There's a lot of room to spread goodwill, kindness, compassion, and have an impact on relieving suffering. The second precept, non-stealing, not taking anything that isn't freely offered. That's been a bit of a challenge for me. I grew up in a house where, since everybody smoked in those days, the ashtrays were from restaurants and hotels all over the country. A few of the towels came from similar places. And My parents were considered highly ethical people, but that was the moray. And since I was a depression baby, I learned early that if it wasn't nailed down, it was mine. And learning to really pay attention to what is being freely offered. And what are we just, from fear or greed or a sense of need or want, lacking, do we just take into our world? Now, Thich Nhat Hanh goes much more deeply in this. For those of you who have done intensive retreat practice and done an eating, one of the things you discover quickly is that it only takes 3 or 4, maybe 5 mouthfuls of food for hunger to be satiated. Doesn't take any more than that if you're eating slowly and consciously. And perhaps another 15 mouthfuls will bring you to satiation. I shouldn't say you. I mean, this is true for me. I don't know what's true for you. The last 200 mouthfuls are all about taste sensations and gluttony and, God, this tastes so good. Thich Nhat Hanh would propose that eating more than you actually require is a form of taking more, of taking that which isn't freely offered. Although there's plenty of food at a typical retreat, that's a little bit of a difficult place for me to go to, as you can see. So there are a lot of ways of playing with how much do we really need? Where are we taking more than is freely offered? And in a culture that is totally based on consumerism, it raises a lot of questions. Now, I caution about trying to get to some of these levels very quickly. Thich Nhat Hanh is essentially a saint. You know, it's cool. He's been through, and he's been a monk for, I don't know, 50, 55 years. For those who are just starting in the practice, and I figure like I'm in first and second grade, and you guys maybe are kindergarten or first grade, there may even be some more second graders in here. Don't drive yourself nuts. Don't try and get some of these very subtle levels, but it's interesting to look at, to see where can we refine our behaviors, where can we refine the ways that we live in the world that are both good for us and good for the environment and the planet. The third precept is really ugly. Right speech. As kids, I'm sure we all learned to lie. I certainly did. You know, if I thought it would get me out of something. I don't think I've met anybody that doesn't do a fair amount of exaggeration, which is, again, another way of cultivating the sense of self. Look at me, I'm important. I know so-and-so, or I did such-and-such. Because the way I've chosen to interpret right speech, I'm a dismal failure, because for me, I think it really includes using language that communicates and doesn't just shock. And I have a long history with four-letter words and such, and it's habitual. And I'm still working. I'll get there. But that kind of language doesn't really communicate anything. And it's harsh language. It's not something that fosters interconnectedness. It doesn't really tell you how I feel or what's going on with me. Some of them might imply that I'm angry, but it would be just as easy to say I'm angry as to say some of the other things I've said. So it's a very subtle place to work. As I say, for me, that is really a difficult task because of my habitual patterns. Every so often I hear a word coming out of my mouth, and it is totally inappropriate. Didn't communicate, it shocked, although in fact it's getting hard to shock people today with four-letter words. But there certainly is nothing harmonious that you're not creating a connectedness, a peacefulness. In addition, the Buddha talked a lot about divisiveness and gossip and talking about people who aren't present, which is basically what gossip is. And words have power. When I do a forgiveness exercise, it's, may I be forgiven for anyone I may have hurt or harmed by thought or word or deed. Words do have power. And when we start using words that are demeaning to other people, I would have to say that's definitely not in the realm of skillful action. We are creating disharmony and being decisive. Excuse me. How does that sound up on the tape? Pretty good? So for me, there's a lot of fun in playing with right speech, even if I get frustrated and have to forgive myself a couple hundred times a day for my ineptitude, unskillfulness, excuse me. I think it's really an interesting place to work. I invite you all to play with these things. The fourth precept is no sexual misconduct. And, you know, that's pretty amorphous. I think there are some pretty obvious areas where you'd get essentially unanimous agreement that's sexual misconduct. But when you're using another person in any kind of way for your own gratification, and that's not based on a whole variety of interactions and interconnections and love and care, you're probably starting to get on dangerous ground. And I don't have an answer to that. I have a pretty good answer for myself because I've gotten so old and my hormones are so low that it's hardly an issue. But thank God. I used to think that would be a terrible thing when it happened. at any rate, it's very interesting to look at what is sexual misconduct. It's obvious to me that any person in authority who is using their position to be sexually involved with somebody who's in their power, I mean, clearly that sexual misconduct. And it's sorry to say that sexual misconduct in spiritual communities is not a rare happening. The Catholic Church has certainly got the brunt of it in recent years, but the fact is that the Buddhist community, both in the U.S. and elsewhere, there have been repeated instances of sexual misconduct by people in authority, by teachers. So it's interesting to look at how we use our sexuality to influence and take advantage of other people. I think, again, that is an area where it is really helpful to look very carefully before you act. The fifth precept, basically the first four precepts, I take not only on retreat, but I take them for my daily life, not in the expectation that I'll have perfection around them. It also gives me a place to practice a lot of forgiveness when I'm unskillful many times a day. The fifth precept I take when I'm on retreat, but I'm not so good about it at home, and so I don't take it for non-retreat times. And that's no alcohol or substances that cloud the mind. Again, there's a great deal of ambiguity around that. There's nothing that says that you can't have a drink. I remember many years ago going to something that I think was ITP, where the Shasta, where the abbot from Mount Shasta was there, walking around with a glass of wine in her hand. And it was like, whoa! Well, you know, is one glass of wine cloud the substances, cloud the mind? Now, Thich Nhat Hanh does something really interesting with that. In his view of interconnectedness, that we are all one, to the extent that we are all one, and the world is filled with lots of alcoholics, when we take a drink, is there an impact on the alcoholics of the world? I'm not there yet. I have no idea. But since I generally do enjoy a beer with dinner, that's why I don't take the fifth precept when I'm not on retreat. There's another whole area, which I don't think people usually talk about in Dharma centers, but there's a vast pharmacology of psychoactive materials that I wouldn't be surprised if a quarter to half of all the Western teachers haven't had experience with, and of the many people I know in meditation practice, a whole lot of them came in because of their experiences with psychoactive materials. I am not recommending psychoactive materials, but that's something, again, for each of you to look at as to what constitutes a substance that clouds the mind. One of the substances that clouds my mind is excessive eating. I can really numb myself out with the second piece of pecan pie. That's just no problem whatsoever. So now I'm probably taking things that aren't freely offered, even though they were sitting on the table, but and I'm clouding the clarity of my mind. And as I said in my little preamble, there's nothing that I'm saying that's got any kind of truth associated with it. The precepts have been in existence for 2,500 years, and if you really like the idea of precepts, you can become a monk or a nun and take on the whole nine yards. But I think they're really useful to investigate. I think there is so much power in pushing on those and seeing where are we being fully human? Where are we being really useful to our communities, to our sangha, to humanity in general, to the planet? I was just about to start to do a political toot, but I think I'll skip it. I think only by really going into the questions that these precepts raise, that the whole issue of morality raises, can we begin to approach our potential. Now, in the West, at least in my experience, the very heavy emphasis is on meditation and retreat practice. In many of the books that I have read from Eastern teachers, They do say that it is very important to deal with the issues of morality before you can expect a whole lot of benefit from your meditation practice. And obviously there's a synergistic effect, that as you start paying attention to the moral qualities in your life, and your meditation practices deepens, the two come together very naturally. But the basics of a moral practice and a moral life are absolutely, in my opinion, essential and inherent if you expect to make any kind of spiritual progress, if you expect to become enlightened. Now you can say, well, see, everybody considered Trungpa Rinpoche an enlightened being, and 42 men and women died of AIDS as a result of their relationship with him. So I don't know, but I'm not Trungpa Rinpoche in a whole variety of ways. So I think these are worth exploring. They're worth thinking about deeply. There are a lot of places where things have been written about them. As I say, the place that I like the best is Thich Nhat Hanh's Buddha Mind, Christ Mind. Or it could be Christ Mind, Buddha Mind. I don't remember. But there are other writings about them, and I would suggest that they're worthwhile areas for exploration. What I'd like to do now is really open up to some questions, people sharing their experiences, arguing with me. Whatever. And if nobody wants to do that, then we can all go back and sit again. Questions? Comments? Yeah?
Can you tell us of the 227 other ones that you mentioned?
Well, I can't do a lot with them, and I'm not sure it's 227 exactly. I think there's 232. Does that sound right? It may only be 208. I may have exaggerated, so that's a problem with right speech. The sixth one, I believe, is not eating after noon. So if you're with the monks from Abagiri, they take their meal at 11:30 and essentially do not eat till the next morning. The seventh one, I believe, is not sleeping in high and luxurious places. That won't be exactly right. And the eighth, if I remember right, is about personal adornments. So that explains all the monks and nuns having their head shaved, all wearing the same kind of robes. Nothing so that you stand out. Of the remainders, if you spend a few years at Abagiri, you can come back and tell us about them.
You know, one of the ones that's really major is no entertainment. That's number 9, I think.
No entertainment. And there's others like no handling money. I know Ajahn Amaro has been here many times. He never carries money. Now, that's sort of handy because he always has somebody around with him to deal with. I wish I didn't have to handle money. I had somebody, you know, that would just deal with all that stuff for me. But then I'd find fault with everything they did, so I'm not sure how useful that would be. They're certainly not allowed to drive. I don't know where that fits in. So there's probably some things, especially around the full moons or the new moons. There's a lot. Yeah. If I can get through the first five one day, I might look into some of the others, but that seems like, for me, a pretty challenging goal. But I love to play with the subtleties. And I will say, because I've been practicing a long time, that my compassion and forgiveness for myself with every, you know, failing is pretty good. So I don't end up beating myself up a couple hundred times a day. Other questions? Yeah.
I don't know if it's a question. I know, like, with the non-killing, non-hurting, my mind, forget the major things. I mean, I'm like, okay, there's an ant crawling across my kitchen sink. I'm going to kill that ant. Because if I don't, there's going to be 500 ants, right? And so then when I started into this practice, I'm going, okay, what do I do? I'm going to have an ant problem. You know, I've got 3 animals, 2 kids, you know, so it's like, and I find myself, okay, being so obsessed with that, you know, that everything, you know, forget everything else, forget, you know, exaggerating, which I do all the time, forget the 4-letter words, which is part of the ant problem. So I find that I start focusing on these little things that, I mean, I guess they're important, you know, I guess I don't want to kill ants or catch flies or, but, you know, it's funny. I don't know if it's funny. I mean, I just wonder how to handle that sort of thing. I mean, that, to me, is the thing that's been weighing on my mind for a year. How do I not kill an ant? Now, if that's not obsessive and, I don't know, self or there's something up there. No. Just in dealing with the subtleties, you know, when you say subtleties and I say, you know, my kids aren't allowed to kill spiders in the house. I say nothing about the little cockroach, the little, you know, pinchers. Can't kill the pinchers. Okay, well then move it out of the house. You know, so how do you deal with the subtleties of that or not get hung up on?
Your ants are hard to move out of the house.
Yeah. Yeah, I take every creature in the house outside and let it go, except for ants. And when you got a swarm of ants, but you see, I'm married to a non-Buddhist, so she takes care of the ants. And every so often, I find it necessary to go back for a few moments and be Jewish and forget this Buddhist stuff. Well, the only answer I can give, because I haven't got a master myself, is first you need to have a lot of kindness and compassion towards yourself and give yourself credit where you are doing the good things. Ants have just been an incredible problem where we live. And when they start swarming, I mean, there are tens of thousands of ants. And it's not too bad anymore because I'm not sure we've improved on anything, but it makes life easier for us. We have somebody spray our foundation 4 times a year so they don't get into the house. So they're probably dying outside where I don't see them. But and I'm not sure I'd say... No, I don't think I ring the I don't think I ring the brass bell on that one, but it's why I do say, be easy with yourself, to try to live fully to all the precepts. You need to be a saint. And are there any saints in this room, by the way? I should ask first. You're getting close. Okay. That's good. So all that's between you and saints are ants. And four letter words and exaggeration. And that's all?
Yeah, I was watching an interview with Dalai Lama, and I was outdoors, you know, and in the middle of the interview, you know, just like, you know, kills a mosquito. Yeah, and you know, and they asked him about it. He says, you know, that kills mosquitoes.
That what?
He does kill mosquitoes. You know, and you know, mosquitoes cause a lot of disease. And
so can flies. You know.
What about
cockroaches?
Uh-huh. I mean, anything can justify it, you know. I mean, not just the dog, but I mean, I don't know. Like, I have to talk about this person outside of their presence because they have some issues that maybe I can help them on without talking. You know, I mean, I think that it's, how far down the slippery slope do you go?
The very fact that you're asking the question means that you're getting close to home. You have the consciousness around it. And so there's also obviously a lot of intention. And in the Buddhist model, the intention is critical. Because again, we, to the extent that we, you know, walk outside, we will kill ants and we will, you know, harm other insects. I mean, it's not possible. But if the intent is not there, in Buddhist cosmology, you're clean as a whistle. I mean, I think these are issues not, how to say this, they are to be mastered in a sense. But my experience is by bringing them into consciousness and playing with them and feeling into them, we can generally do better than we were before. And, you know, that's that's doing quite a lot. I mean, attaining perfection. You're a lot younger than I am. Maybe you have, maybe you'll get there this time. Yeah.
I'm fairly new to this. Do I assume from the discussion that Buddhists are vegetarians?
Not all. The Dalai Lama is not a vegetarian.
I didn't know how, you know, doing harm, killing animals, fish. I mean, I didn't know how far.
Well, but then what's to say that we're doing more harm when we kill a fish than when we break a ear of corn off a plant? So
that's what I was wondering, to what extent.
Again, it's about bringing your consciousness to it. Now, the Dalai Lama, first of all, coming from Tibet, you know, they don't have a lot of fruits and vegetables in Tibet. It's 13,000 feet, the Tibetan plateau. And it's much milder than you might think. But still, the array of foods that they have to eat are pretty limited. And the Dalai Lama, I read someplace, said his body just requires a certain amount of meat.
Excuse me, you just very recently, which I being a vegetarian and kind of supporting that point of I was glad to hear that he stopped eating meat.
He has stopped
and
eating
meat. And what he had done, his doctor had recommended, had told him he wanted to eat meat. So what he did was he would only eat meat every other day. So he said, now at least half my life I'm a vegetarian. And but recently, I guess he's figured out a way how to keep his health according to his position, you know, and he's a vegetarian again. So.
But it's interesting because when I heard of Steve, most of the Tibetan, a lot of the Tibetan culture, they eat goat a lot. I mean, they just eat what they raise. And that, you know, he said that I'm not going to put down anyone who is eating to survive. Is eating because that's what you have. If the food is put in front of you, you know, you eat it. You don't kind of say, well, I can't do this because I'm a vegetarian. So, I mean, I know for him, I mean, it sounds like, you know, he had a big issue with it.
And but is the goal to be to not eat meat at least? Is that the sort of attainable goal, or there's no real?
No, there's no.
No, I would say not.
There's no real.
And I would say that if you're going, if you want to pursue that, which lots of people do, you probably want to be paying a lot of attention to your own body and the nutrients you're getting, and maybe even initially doing it with some doctor supervision. Because if you don't pay attention to the getting the full range of nutrients, and they can be done, so I'm told. I was born, raised, eating meat 21 meals a week. A meal wasn't a meal unless we had meat. You know, I've made a lot of progress, but,
The fifth one,
substances that cloud the mind.
Does that in its purest form include medication?
To the best of my knowledge, the answer to that would be no. Using the Dalai Lama as an example, he is first and foremost a pragmatist. I mean, he looks at what works and what doesn't work. And a number of years ago, I heard him speak in the Greek theater, and somebody asked, in Berkeley, and somebody asked him what his position was on birth control. And traditionally, Buddhists have been opposed to birth control. And in his own inimitable way, he said, that's not a problem for me. He said, you know, I'm a celibate monk, so... But he came out very strongly in favor of birth control because he said he has traveled the world and he has seen the harm done by phenomenal overpopulation, and he sees that as contributing more suffering to the world than preventing births. So, you know, that's one aspect. I think I have a history of depression, and for the last 7 or 8 years I've been on a low dose of Prozac. And I had a lot of issues around that when it looked like it was necessary for me to do that. And I went to a psychiatrist who was a very active Buddhist practitioner. And his answer was, if your thyroid wasn't functioning, you'd take thyroid medication. If you're not producing a sufficient serotonin, you know, you need to take that. So, but I, you know, they're very interesting questions, because I was a stockbroker, and when I started taking Prozac, I started making different decisions. I became more confident, not as depressed, more optimistic. And I was managing $150 million of other people's money, and I was taking a more aggressive stance. And that, you know, that took a lot of looking at. Well, yeah, but maybe the problem was you were doing a lousy job before because you were depressed and staying defensive. If you've experienced depression, I have been dysfunctional with depression where I couldn't go to work. So, yeah. So this is the joy for me of the practice. It's not because there's a right answer, but to really explore it and to come to the fullness of it and see what your truth is around it in a very practical, realistic way. And in one sense, Buddhist practice can be I better change this because I'm not sure this is Buddhist practice. It's how I run my life. If it works, do it. And if it doesn't work, stop doing it and try something else. So I also am a pragmatist, and if you're depressed and you're not functional and you're not treating the people around you very well, clearly anything that will help you relate in a kinder, more compassionate way with other people has got to be net good, in my opinion.
You know, if they look really funky, to tell them, you know, to not let them go out of the house looking like, you know, totally foolish. And but it's like, how do I say this in a way that builds them up, probably like a kid, you know, instead of tearing them down and hurting them? It's really a hard one for me, especially there, because it seems like, you know, my job is always to be correcting and showing this and this. You know, sometimes I just want to let it go.
You know, I think the key to that is to pay attention whether you're coming from compassion. If you're coming from compassion, pretty much whatever you do, one of my all-time favorite stories, which has nothing to do with Buddhism, it came out of A Course in Miracles, was I was doing a series of workshops with a guy who was brilliant, Julian Silverman, who was director of research at Esalen, and he had done drug stuff when that was prevalent at Esalen, and psychosynthesis when Asa Joly was there, and gestalt therapy with Fritz Perls. And one day he just stumbled on the three volumes of The Course in Miracles and he got totally captured. And so my wife and I would get down occasionally and do a weekend with him because it was always fun. This guy was a handsome, Semitic, very brilliant, very funny guy. He could have been on the Yiddish stage like Zero Mostel. And we went down for one weekend, the weekend before Thanksgiving. And we were going up to my mother-in-law's for Thanksgiving. And Julian started off by saying, this is very simple. This whole course of miracles, this weekend, is only one thing you have to get. He said, your only job is you shine your light, you beam your love at your brothers and sisters. I raised my hand. I said, Julian, come Thanksgiving, I'm going to be with somebody who's really toxic. How do I deal with that? He said, I just told you. He said, your only job is you shine your light, you beam your love. I said, Julian, I don't think you heard the question. So I'm going to be with my mother-in-law. And she is really a difficult person, and no matter what I do, it's going to be wrong. He said, what are you, dumb? Here's the answer. You just shine your light, you beam your love. That's it. I said, Julian, I promise, this is the last pass, but I got to make one more pass. Last year when I was there, I cut up the giblets for the gravy. I cut up 9,762 pieces, 6,408 were too large, 3,709 were too small. Not one was the right size. I said, how do you... He said, okay, just listen one more time. He said, your only job is to shine your light and beam your love. And when you can't do that anymore, get out of there. Because if you're not shining your light, not beaming your love, you are doing something else, and you are now part of the problem. You're not the solution. So I trust that really a lot, that if you're coming from the right place, that's what you're transmitting. And then to the extent that you can sharpen your language, like stupid would be one of those words I want to take out of my vocabulary because it's not a word that communicates anything. I mean, so you get to play with the words, but that's sort of the fun. That's the kick I gotta get out of working with all of this stuff. So. And then the other thing that's really great is to be able to go back and clean up the mess you created. And that is done, I've done some teaching over at the Stanford Business School with second year MBA students. Boy, when I model going back and apologizing and admit that I did something wrong, it freaks these 28-year-olds out like nobody's business. They don't have a model. They've never seen people own their mistakes and come back and say, wow, I blew it. I think I may have damaged our relationship. What is it we can start to work on to heal the wound? So I don't worry too much anymore about damaging, a relationship, provided I'm with a person that I think is willing to come back and work the relationship. Unfortunately, this past quarter at Stanford, I had a disaster with somebody who was not willing to come back and work with one of my screw-ups, and it was a bad scene. But let's sit for about a minute, mindfully, consciously, body erect and relaxed. For being here and sharing my joy with me.